Okay, friends, Greg Kokol, Stand to Reason here. You guys can't see what's going on here behind the scenes, but Derek was giving me the go, go, go on the screen, and I was dinking around trying to find something that I lost, and that's why, okay, I better jump in here so I don't have dead air, because dead air is bad for radio. Greg Kokol here, Stand to Reason, and thank you for being part of our show, and I'm looking forward to talking with Timothy and Jeffrey and Al, because we finally got Comrex up. That means I can actually take calls. It's been 2 weeks since we've done that, and so I'm glad to have you in the queue here for this show, and I will be getting to you in just a bit. I wanted to read something to you. What happened earlier, was it, I don't know, today when Amy and I were doing STR Ask, or maybe yesterday during our, we had Mondays, sometimes we have our what I call our discipleship or mentoring meeting. So I get together with Alan and Amy and Tim and John, and we kind of knock things around here, and we're doing it all on screen, but we get off on some tangents that are a lot of fun. It's too bad you guys can't be a fly on the wall in those kinds of conversations. But we were talking about what a mess things are right now. And I mean, like, and I keep saying this, but I think that I've said this for now a couple of years, but it seems like every time, every couple of months, things have changed and we've ratcheted up to a different speed, so to speak, in our culture of crazy things happening. And then something else, you don't think it can get any crazier. And I'm not saying worse, because it can get a lot worse. We got it pretty good in America. We've got it better than any Christian has had for the last 2,000 years, all right? And we've got it better than just about any other Christian in any other part of the world, certainly the developing countries. We got it pretty good. But even so, it still can get crazy. I mean, did I read yesterday that in Oakland now. What's happening in Oakland? It used to be like Seattle and Chicago and Portland, all these riots and stuff. Portland, 80 days now of riots. But now in Oakland, I read, they were chanting death to America. I saw a meme the other day. Am I getting this word right? I saw a meme the other day. It says, America must be a pretty great country if those people who hate it so much won't leave it. So I don't want to make – this is not a political screed, but I'm just saying, doesn't that just sound absolutely bizarre? What's going on? It's crazy. It's just – you expect somebody in other countries, like in the Middle East – you know, saying death to Americans, burning the president in effigy, burning American flags and all that stuff. But it's happening by American citizens now. So that's just crazy. And it does have ramifications for us, because the social fabric is getting ripped to shreds in certain areas. And it turns out that a lot of the hostility that is being expressed now against the broad oppressors of culture, and this is critical theory stuff that we've begun talking about the last couple of months, it turns out that Christians are part of that oppressor group. And so we're the bad people. And it's portrayed that way for a long time in the film industry. And it's characterized that way in the university. And now it's more and more creeping into culture. Now, there's a big, solid, giant middle America, I think, and that is strong and powerful and noble and good and Christian by and large, or at least informed by Christian sensibilities. And so I have a lot of confidence in that part of America. But on the fringes, and the fringes would be like the coasts, you have something different going on, a whole different. And sometimes, boy, it rattles. Speaking autobiographically here, it rattles my cage. And, you know, my wife and my daughters have to tell me, just shut up, you know, let it lie. Don't talk about this anymore, because I get to crabbing and talking about it and reflecting on it. And the reason that I do is because I keep being astounded at how ridiculous things have gotten. Just the things that people say and the things that people believe. It's upside down. Black is white and white is black. Okay. I'm just using a metaphor there. I'm not speaking about racial things. I'm just using it. Things are up is down and down is up, Right is left and left is right. It's all upside down, inside out, and backwards. People don't see the world the way it really is. They see, what do they see? Now, in the past, I have talked about this, that when there is a display of sentiment that is that is contrary to fact and contrary to the nature of reality, and obviously so, for example, that Islam is a peaceful religion. What? Please. But people believe that. They think Islam means peace. No, it doesn't. It means submission. It's not a screed against Islam. It's just an observation about the nature of Islam and what people end up saying about it. That's crazy. It's the opposite, historically, of the way that religion as a religion has comported itself, and certainly the way it's been in the last 20 years in the world. And I'm not saying this is true with every Muslim, but in characteristic, this is, you can't go a day without another report of something like that. So why are people saying, well, it's basically a peaceful religion? Well, it's upside down what they're saying. Okay, a boy is a girl, a girl is a boy. You know, as a male is a female, as a female is a male. I mean, this is upside down. You're not a female, you're a male. You're setting up in the blocks down the line from an all-female runners and one male is there. Do you imagine, and I just read this recently, the kind of feeling that the female racer has when she looks down the line just before the gun goes off so they can run their race and she sees a guy there racing against her as a girl? So I'm just giving characteristics of the upside-downness of the culture. And what I've said in the past is this is a tell. When things are clearly upside down, particular things are clearly upside down, and these things have spiritual ramifications. I mentioned Islam. Well, Islam is a deadly enemy of Christianity and Judaism. So this, it has spiritual ramifications. And it's upside down. This is a tell. This is an evidence, I think, of spiritual warfare. Because when you read about the devil, the most salient detail that we learn about the devil is that he's a deceiver. He trades in lies. Jesus said the devil is a liar. He speaks from his own nature. That's the way he plays the game. And he lies with such persuasiveness, I guess, of some sort, that he can actually blind people so they cannot see the obvious truth. And we see that in multiple passages, not just that he's a deceiver, but that he blinds. The whole world lies in the power of the evil one. It says in 1 John chapter 5, 2 Timothy chapter 2, that he holds the whole world captive to do his will. He has blinded the eyes of the unbeliever, it says in 2 Corinthians chapter 4. So there are all these different places that when it makes reference to the devil, it identifies his most cogent characteristic, and that is his deceptive nature, and that in employing the deceptive nature and the lies in the world, he deceives and holds captive those who he has deceived. And this is why when Paul talks about spiritual warfare, he's talking in Ephesians 6. He says there's all kinds of things going on behind the scenes that are having an impact here. Now, you and I, because we're Westerners, we're Americans in particular, most of us, I mean, obviously people listen all over the world, but Westerners, especially modern people, maybe I should put it that way. Though Christians and acknowledging the reality of the spiritual realm, we are not really culturally engineered to take it that seriously. And so it registers with us with the power that it ought to. Now, there are people in other countries where the supernatural is much more at hand, so to speak, and therefore they have a deeper respect for this kind of thing, and traffic in it more effectively too, I think, than we do. And this is one reason we have to keep reminding ourselves, listen, our battle is not against flesh and blood. We are face to face with flesh and blood, but behind it is a spiritual force of wickedness in heavenly places that is doing this. And I think that's a powerful influence on the way people respond. How do you overcome that? You don't. The Holy Spirit does. We don't. But what do? We speak the truth clearly and graciously and persuasively and let God take care of the rest. And that's where our role as Christian apologists comes in, to give you a footing in the conversation and also to keep you from being taken in by that deceptive influence, which can sound very persuasive. And this is why Paul says, do not be taken captive by philosophy and empty deception, according to the traditions of men, rather than according to Christ. And so these were the ideas we were banging around a little bit when we were conversing. And I thought of 2 Corinthians, I'm turning to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Pardon my rattle. And here we have some discussion about the second coming and how there's going to be an apostasy and a man of lawlessness will be revealed. And there's a lot of takes on how this will play out. But I think the point that I want to make is pretty straightforward from this passage. And what Paul says here to the Thessalonians, he says that the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. Only he who restrains will do so until he is taken out of the way. I think, what is it that restrains? It's God's that is restraining, and when his restraint is removed, then things will, you know, all completely go to hell, kind of literally. And then Paul says, then when the restraint is removed, then that lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will slay with the breath of his mouth and bring to an end by the appearance of his coming. Ooh, cool. That is, then more detail about that one who will be slain, because there's a lag in time before he's revealed and then he's slain. There's bad stuff that happens. That's the one whose coming is in accord with the activity of Satan. Oh, he's behind this. With all power and signs and false wonders. People who are just taken by miracles, oh man, did you see that? That was like supernatural. That's the only explanation. Therefore, it must be right. No. Jesus warned about it in Matthew 24. Here's Paul warning about it in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Satan with all power and signs and false wonders and with all deception. There's that word. Oh, it's not just deception. It's deception of wickedness. That is, the wicked, they are deceived. They are deceived. It seems to me he's saying that they are deceived. And part of what they're deceived at is that the wickedness they do doesn't seem like wickedness to them. It's a deception of wickedness for those who perish. Why? Okay, now this is really key. Because they did not receive the love of the truth so as to be saved. When Amy and I were talking, Amy said, you know, people just don't love the truth. They are just completely relativistic. And I agreed in general, but I wanted to make a refinement. I think people love truth when it supports what they want to do. And they're all over it then. Does the Constitution guide us? Yes, the Constitution guides us. As long as the Constitution says what we want it to say, or let's see, when it says what will help us get what we want in that moment. But if the Constitution read in a conservative way in the minds of the founders doesn't meet what we want now it's a living Constitution, then it means something, whatever we want it to mean. In other words, the thing that is driving them, and this is Amy's point, is not truth. The thing that is driving them is what they want. And when the truth serves that end, they're all for the truth. And when the truth does not serve that end, well, they're going to do something else. They're not going to be consistent. They're not going to play by the rules. They're going to do whatever they need to do to get what they want. You know why? Because they count themselves as the center. That's the hunger for autonomy, to do what one wants to do for himself. I did it my way, kind of thing, to quote Frank Sinatra. But he was just quoting the ethos of history, not just of a time in history. This is the way fallen people are. It goes all the way back to the garden. And then Paul then says, because they did not love the truth, this is what makes them vulnerable to the deception. And then Paul says, okay, so they don't love the truth. They're vulnerable to deception. Okay, we're going to give you what you want. And it says there next, and this is, if you read it by itself instead of in the context, this throws some people off. But here's what it says. For this reason, that is that they did not love the truth so as to be saved. For this reason, I should say they did not receive the love of the truth so as to be saved. For this reason, God will send upon them a deluding influence so that they will believe what's false. Oh, that's what you want? Fine. In order that they may be judged who did not believe the truth, but what's the alternative? Took pleasure in wickedness. Took pleasure in wickedness. They did not receive the love of the truth. They received the love of wickedness. And Jesus makes a comment very similar to this in John chapter 3. The light has come into the world, but men loved darkness rather than light because their deeds were evil. All right? That's what we're up against. So we have a hypostatic union here of evil. We have the devil deceiving people who want to be deceived, who are willing to be deceived in order to pursue their wickedness. 100% devil, 100% fallen man. Okay? That's a mess. So I'll close with this thought here because there's an application now. It's from Philip Schaff. Schaff wrote The Creeds of Christendom. It's a book that should be in any thoughtful Christian's library because it helps you to see the progress and development and defense of biblical truth over the ages, Philip Schaff. And in fact, it's in the Creeds of Christendom that I have my record of what actually happened at Nicaea. So if you hear people say, well, the Council of Nicaea took reincarnation out of the Bible, or they put this in, or they made Jesus the Son of God and when he wasn't, and all this stuff people say about the Council of Nicaea, you want to know what happened? There's the records of the Council of Nicaea. Schaff has it in Creeds of Christendom. In any event, he makes this observation. He says, infidels are seldom convinced by argument, for the springs of unbelief are in the heart rather than in the head. They did not receive the love for the truth so as to be saved, as Paul's words. 2 Thessalonians 2. The springs of unbelief are in the heart rather than in the head. But, and now he's making a contrast, but honest inquirers and earnest skeptics, nothing wrong with being a skeptic, but depends on your heart. He says, like Nathaniel or Thomas, who love the truth and wish only for tangible support of their weak faith, will never refuse when the evidence is laid before them to embrace it with grateful joy, and to worship the incarnate God. Ooh, that's pretty good. Anyway, good thought to start this hour on. Let's take a break as you chew on that, and then we'll go to your calls on Stand to Reason.
Would you like a Stand to Reason speaker to speak at your church or event? Greg, Alan, Tim, and our newest apologist, John Noyes, are available, both in person and online. Just email booking@str.org to schedule them today. Our speakers can address a wide array of topics, from bioethics, gender issues, and science, to theology, philosophy, and how to respond to other worldviews, all from a biblical perspective. Whether it's a Sunday sermon, Zoom conference, or YouTube live event, our skilled and engaging speakers can be there, either physically or virtually, with the goal of equipping Christians to effectively influence the culture for Christ. To read their bios and learn more about the topics they cover, visit str.org. Then email booking@str.org to schedule Greg, Alan, Tim, or John today.
What does a bushel of corn and a 2002 Dodge Neon have to do with apologetics? When donated, both enabled STR to provide Christians like you with the resources you need to gain confidence in defending your faith. There are some really creative ways to support STR financially. You can easily give items like vehicles, stock, jewelry, and gift cards through STR's partnership with iDonate. iDonate takes care of selling the items and then gives the proceeds to STR. You can also give through the purchases you're already making on Amazon. Visit Amazon Smile and select Stand to Reason as your charity of choice. Amazon will then donate a portion of what you spend. You'll find all the information on creative ways to give by going to str.org/donate. Donation questions link at the bottom of the page will give you all the information you need. That's str.org/donate.
All right, friends, Greg Kogel here, back with you, giving you a piece of my mind as I do on Tuesdays. Characteristically, I've just been doing the math on this almost 30 years now. So, long time. Actually, more than 30. I started in 1990. February 2020 was my 30-year anniversary. Now we're halfway through that year. Boy, they're passing fast. Let's go to the calls here, and let me see if I can make this work. I think I've got Tim in Ohio. Tim?
Yes. How are you, Greg?
Hey, good. It says Timothy. Do you prefer Timothy, or is Tim fine?
It doesn't matter. I get the question all the time, so I just tell people it doesn't matter.
How about the T-Man?
Yeah, I've gotten about everything.
All right, just kidding with you. So what's on your mind, Tim?
So I'm in an engineering ethics class. I'm a senior in college, and my professor had some points on divine command theory that seemed to miss, and I wanted to get your thoughts.
Okay, sure. Right. Divine command, just so people know who are listening, divine command theory is a way of understanding how the ethics or moral project works. And the idea is that things are right or wrong in virtue of God's commands. Now, more could be said about it, but that's basically divine command. Right and wrong is determined by what God says.
Yeah. So what he set out to do, he seems to support an objective morality, but he hasn't provided a basis yet. And he's gone through cultural relativism, subjectivism, emotivism, and other things. And he's hit upon divine command theory as well as natural law theory. And so my questions, the two questions that he brought up for divine command theory, the first one, the one that I kind of like to tackle a little more, says, is something wrong because God commands it? And then the implications, he says, of that first question is God commands. God could have commanded otherwise. Therefore, God commands are arbitrary, and we don't have to follow them.
Right.
And so my thoughts were off the top of my head. God couldn't have commanded otherwise. They're based in his nature, therefore not arbitrary. And since he controls the show, we are obligated to follow them.
Yeah. Kind of. I think your instinct is right by talking about his nature. This is called Euthyphro or Euthyphro's dilemma, all right? And it was voiced early on, 400 years before Christ, with Socrates, I believe. And so this is all part of a dialogue that was had there. And it raises a very legitimate question, and it has to do with the nature of the grounding of morality. Given morality is objective, and you wouldn't have this particular discussion if morality wasn't objective, because the morality can be completely explained by emotions, emotivism, or by some kind of subjective commitment to one's own beliefs. That's standard relativism. But if you think that there is an objective grounding, morals are objective, then it's fair to ask, well, where is that object? What is the nature of the grounding of it? The problem arises if we say the gods, the way Socrates would have put it, are the grounding of morality, then the question could be put, and this is the way in Euthyphro or Euthyphro it's put, do the gods say it's right because it's right, or is it right because the gods say it? And this is just exactly what your professor has offered you. Now, this is a dilemma, but it's a false one, because it only offers two options, and there is a middle choice, Okay. It is not just simply a matter of God saying it as if right and wrong is a function of his whim in any given moment, because that would actually just be a sophisticated form of relativism, you know. And it isn't that there is some standard outside of God that he is pointing to, and that would make him less than God because he'd be beholden to that outside standard as well, and therefore he'd be somewhat contingent. And by the way, those are the two horns of the dilemma. You're damned if you do and damned if you don't kind of thing. And the answer, and this is, I just continue to be amazed that this question comes up so frequently from people who ought to know better, that the problem has been solved. And it was solved like Augustine had a solution to it. Aquinas probably addressed it. And what you just said really is at the heart of the solution. I mean, lots of folk can just figure this out themselves. From the Christian perspective, in other words, this is the way the Christian would answer it. And when I say from the Christian perspective, I'm not saying this, well, that's just our belief system. What we're saying is our answer to the question solves the dilemma. So we are not strapped with this defeater. And that is that the grounding for morality is in the character of God. It is not merely in his will. So he could say rape is wrong today, but he could say it's right tomorrow because he's changed his mind. But rather, but his will is an expression of his character, which is fixed and objective. Okay? It is not outside of him. But it is simply not. It is not just a simple voluntary action of God's. That's called voluntarism. God's commands are beholden upon us, on those who he commands, because he is, his character is the objective moral standard of the universe. So now a professor could just reject that. Okay, and he's free to do so, but now he's faced with another problem. If he believes that morals are objective, now he's got to ground that morality in a way that makes sense of the morality we actually encounter. Okay, and what he's got, I think, to be fair, he would have to say, okay, Christian, I understand your answer, and your view is not subject to this objection. So all we're doing here when we give our answer to the challenge of the dilemma is not to prove that our view is right, but rather to show that our view is not subject to this defeater. So we are defeating a defeater. That's kind of what's going on here. Mm-hmm. So when you told this to your professor, what was his response?
Well, to be fair, the class is entirely online. I see. I don't have a lot of face-to-face interaction with him.
Yeah.
So I'm just parroting what he's told me.
Huh. So I don't know what's wrong with that. I just don't. And I haven't ever heard anything that is like a rejoinder to it. It solves the problem. There's a middle option mm-hmm. that's not mentioned. It's a false dichotomy that Socrates offers. And right. And it's been answered by Christian thinkers down through the ages.
So, if I may.
Sure.
So since he seems to support an objective morality, but he will not subscribe to divine command theory or even any other form of ethics, if you will, that he's supposed, what could he possibly use? I mean, I don't think he can use anything, but what do you think he's possibly going to get to that? Would he redefine objective or what do you think he would go?
Well, if I understood your question, that he believes in objective morality, but he rejects divine command theory because of the Euthyphro dilemma, and so he must have some other way of grounding it. Is that what you're asking?
Right.
Well, I only know of one other way of grounding objective morality, okay? There's only one other way I know of grounding it other than a personal divine being who is this, whose character is the standard for morality. And that is called moral Platonism, as in Plato, okay? Mm-hmm. And Plato was the guy. So it was Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. The three generations, they knew each other, or at least Plato knew Socrates and Aristotle knew Plato. They were students of each other, so to speak. So that you had right. all of this intense brilliance in a very – located in a small geographical area in a short period of history. And Plato is famous for his idea about the forms and that that we live in kind of a shadowy realm right now, but the real – the deep reality is the ideals, the forms and ideal forms, so to speak. I'm not a big student of this, so I can't get into detail. It's not really necessary. But according to Plato, there could be just – these abstract objects that are moral objects, like there could be kindness. There's a perfect ideal of kindness and a perfect ideal of love or any other moral virtue that you could think of. Those exist, and they are not tied to anything. They are not grounded in God. They are primitives. They just exist on their own, and they're just out there, okay? And so we have a way – they are objective features of the universe that are abstract objects that are real, but they're not personal, okay? And that is a way, at least in principle, of making sense of the existence of objective morality without appealing to God. But there's a problem with it, and the problem is abstract objects are inert. That means they don't do anything. The number two is an abstract mm-hmm. object, all right? The number two doesn't do anything. It just kind of sits out there. The Pythagorean theorem, you know, you could think of it as an abstract object, if you will, but it doesn't do anything. Abstract objects are causally inert, to use the language of a philosopher. But it turns out when we think about morality, we realize that the essence of morality is obligation. That is, if there is a moral element that's objective, it makes a claim on our behavior. We're obliged to it. We ought to be kind. It's not just kindness sitting out there, but we ought to be kind. And by the way, we are human beings. It isn't computers or car bumpers or chimpanzees or amoeba. It's human beings. Why is the oughtness of morality, why does it exist to begin with, and why does it apply to us? So these are features of morality that need to be explained by our explanation of morality. And if you want to go, okay, objective morality, but not God, abstract objects, moral Platonism. Okay, well, you solved one problem, but now you're facing two others. It doesn't have adequate explanatory power to clarify the whole project that we're aware of and we're trying to explain. However, the Christian worldview makes perfect sense because now we have an infinite mind who is morally perfect, who is the ground for morality. That makes sense. And all I'm saying right now is this is all – makes sense. That's all I'm saying. You don't have to say it. It's true. When enough things make sense as an answer to what we experience, it starts to feel true. Or it's legitimate to say more and more, well, I think I've got a true explanation of things because all these things begin to fit. And it also then makes sense of the idea of obligation, because we are obliged not just to an abstract principle, but to an individual who makes commands based on his moral character. And so now we're obliged to obey a command. Kindness is not a command. It's just a thing. Okay. But you ought to be kind is a moral statement, or be kind. That's a command. Or don't be unkind. Another command. And so since we have an obligation regarding moral things, we need to have a conceptual framework that allows us to understand how that works. And the Christian worldview works perfectly to do that. You don't have to be a philosopher and know all about inert objects and all that other things that are not causally, you know, you don't need to know that. You just see, well, that makes sense. If I feel I ought to do something, it's because there is something I ought to do, and I can only ought to do it if somebody's oughting me. Kind of.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So okay. I think we're in a good place with regards to our own commitments. Make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. If I could just cap off with one final recommendation.
Do I have a recommendation? Right? A final? Say again.
Yeah, well, I want to ask this question as a quick follow-up as a recommendation. Is that okay?
Yeah, real quickly, I got some other people I want to get to. But.
Sure. Do you have any recommended resources for things like social contract theory, Kantian ethics, things like that, just to familiarize myself with.
It's a little fuzzy there. A recommendation. Did you say something about time or about the issue we were talking about divine command?
No, about Kantian ethics and social contract.
Oh, Kantian ethics. Oh. You know, I've got ethics books on my case over here. I'm looking at them. They're books that I've had for a long time. Kantian ethics are duty-based ethics. I guess no, not off the top of my head. It's been a long time since I read any of those books. So one of the best, I'm trying to look at the titles because my eyes are not focusing well, but one of the best books that I have is a book by Lewis Poiman, Pojman. And it's called Discovering Right and Wrong. That was a great book. Lewis Poiman, Pojman, Discovering Right and Wrong. That's what I recommend. I don't know how much he talks about Kant, but he was a great resource to me just to understand all these things. Sound good?
Okay.
Okay,
perfect.
Gotta go.
Thanks, Greg.
Okay, Timothy, by the way, if you get further on in the course and you have more questions, give me a call.
Will do. Thanks, Greg.
Okay, sounds good. We're going to skip the break because I want to get to our people. I haven't talked to people for so long on this show here. So let's talk with Jeffrey in Florida. Hey, Jeff.
Hello, Mr. Kokel. How's it going?
It's going okay.
Yeah.
Are you guys getting ready to get blown away there? Isn't there like a big storm coming up?
Yeah, I mean, it was supposed to be a big deal from what we heard, but at least up the in northern Florida here, we dodged it. We dodged the bullet. So,
good for you.
I think we're good to go.
Okay, my brother's down in Sarasota way, so maybe he's still got trouble down there. I don't know.
Oh, yeah, maybe. I'm not sure yet. I didn't know if anything's coming that way.
Okay, so
but, we're clear up here.
Okay, so you got one of those nefarious why questions.
Yeah. So. Yeah, just the preface it. You know, I'm reading your tactics book now, and I appreciate your work that you've done on that. And I really I'm enjoying the book, and definitely see God's work being done through you, and I definitely appreciate the glory you're bringing Him at this time. So thank you for that. In general, I just in general, a question that comes up when I speak to atheists and agnostics do a lot of probably unfortunate social media talking to people.
Right.
That's how people converse these days. And it's not always the best way because it's dehumanizing, but sometimes it's the only way.
Point.
So
I do understand.
And a lot of times the question, they do come up is, and I can't always answer it that well, is, essentially, why did God create anything at all? Like, why did He create humankind? Why did He create the universe?
Got it.
At all.
Right. Well, let me give you some thoughts on that will help you, okay? What if I just said, I don't know? I mean, from the perspective of the skeptic or the atheist, if I just said, I don't know. I don't know why God did that. Sounds crazy to me. If I were Him, I wouldn't have done that. Made a bunch of people like us? Forget about that. That's no fun. What if we just said, well, I don't know, which I think is, in many cases, is a completely legitimate answer. Now, I have more to say about it than this, but here's what I want you to see. I want you to see when people ask questions like that have to do with the intentions of God and we can't answer them, that has absolutely no bearing on whether or not our view is true. Listen, are you married?
Yes.
Okay. Did you ever ask why did my wife – ask yourself. You don't ask her this. This is not safe. You ask yourself, why did my wife do that? Okay. Mm-hmm. You ever do that?
Yeah.
Yeah, fess up. Come on. I know you're a married guy. All right. Okay, Jeff. So
yeah.
You're asking yourself, why did my wife do that? And guess what? You have no answer. Now, let me ask you a question. When you ask yourself the question, why did my wife do that, and you have no answer, does your wife disappear? No.
Not.
The fact that you don't know why she does something has no bearing on whether she is or not. And I don't know why. There are skeptics and atheist types that pursue certain lines of questioning and challenge that if I were an atheist, I would never pursue, because I don't think they're intellectually dignified. I think it's undignified. And when I say undignified, it's just a nice way of saying it's dumb. It's dumb. Look, I'm not going to say, atheist, prove to me a universal negative. You can't say God doesn't exist, because you can only say that if you're omniscient. And if you are omniscient, then you would be God. Well, I don't do that. I think that's an unfair challenge on an atheist, because I think that's kind of a dumb appeal. You know, prove the – because that then becomes a – you can't disprove leprechauns or, you know, a whole bunch of other things that people young people believe in. So I wouldn't do that, because it's undignified. It's kind of a dumb way of trying to make my point. I don't want to make my point in a dumb way. I don't want to disabuse somebody of a false – what I think is a false idea in a dumb way. But I think this is kind of a dumb way to go after Christians. Well, then why did God – he had a bad hair day. I don't know. So what? So if I say no, then therefore what? Okay. That God doesn't exist, because I don't know why he made the world. No. See, so this is what I want you to be clear on, is just because you can't answer questions like that. Why did God create the devil? Why did God make human beings when he knew they were going to sin? Why did he make mosquitoes, for goodness sake? And why didn't Noah smack those two when he had the chance? Actually, he only had to smack one of them when he had the chance. What's up with that? And here's the answer. I don't know. All right?
Yeah.
But the fact that you don't know the mind of God is not an argument in any way, shape, or form against God. So that's the rock-solid stuff I want you to hold on to. Okay, now... there's nothing wrong, of course, with us speculating. What was that? Is that one of the mosquitoes?
that's one of the little guys.
Okay, so there's nothing wrong with us speculating and asking, well, yeah. I don't know, based on what we do know, can we come up with some possibilities that might be possible? I think the answer is yes, we can. And I actually do talk about this a little bit in the book, The Story of Reality. Have you read that book?
Nope.
You haven't read my book, The Story of Reality? And you have the audacity to call me on the phone and ask, oh my goodness. Okay, well, I'm just telling, I'll give you the free shot right now. Say again?
I said, that'll be the next one on the list.
There you go. And then you'll be asking questions about that. Why did Kokel write that book? Well, I could tell you why I wrote it if you ask me, but I can't tell you why God created it, because he's not talking. Not about that. So anyway, in the book, what I point out is, first of all, and this you can bank on, God didn't need to create anything. He didn't need to create because he's not contingent. He has no needs. He does what he enjoys doing. What he likes to do, not what he has to do. He does those things consistent with his nature that flow from his nature, but he has no needs. In fact, he didn't have to create to love, given that love is other-oriented, because he already was loving within the context of the Trinity, Father, Son, Holy Ghost, from time immemorial. All right? So God doesn't have needs, but he wanted to. Now, what might be a motivation for God to create anything? Well, why do we make things? I'm a woodworker, kind of, once in a while. It's because I enjoy forming things with my hands. So I make something. In fact, I'm looking at a little, my camera now here on my computer. I have this one of these Logies cameras, mm-hmm. and I have a plexiglass thing that I cut out and sanded the edges, and I heated up and bent it over, and I added some stuff to attach my Logie camera on so I could hang it on my big screen, which I don't have a camera on. So I did that, and every time I look at it, I feel good because I made that. Okay, so there is a satisfaction in making things, okay? And maybe God just likes making stuff, okay? That's believable. I didn't have to make these things, but I enjoyed doing it. Okay, so there's one thing. Here's another thing, though. I think that one of the reasons that God made human beings is not that he had to, but he wanted them to share in his happiness. Now, because God is perfectly good, he is perfectly happy. Happiness is grounded. Genuine happiness is grounded in goodness. Evil people aren't happy. They may be self-satisfied in the moment, but their natures are not satisfied because our natures are not made for that. We have to be good before we can be happy. It's a little bit of another issue, but the point is that God goodness makes him happy, and he wants to share as an overflow of his goodness into the lives of us. And that is what the grace of God is all about. It is unmerited favor. So we are getting something we did not deserve because God is good, and he likes to give from his nature in a loving fashion. So there's a speculation, and I do talk about it a little bit. He wants us to share in his happiness, and so this is why he made us. But this is a problem now when we're bad in the fall. Now we're not happy. Things aren't good the way they were meant to be, and now we're in trouble with God, and so he's got to solve this problem. And that's what the story of reality is all about, how through history and in very particular ways through Jesus, he solves that problem. All right? Make sense?
Yeah.
All right, I got to run because I got another caller on board, and I want to get to that person. I want to get to Al. So thank you, Jeffrey. Okay, I appreciate your call. Don't get blown away there in Florida. Maybe you dodged that bullet. In Dallas, Texas, this is Al.
Hi, hey, Greg. Al. Thanks for taking my call. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing fine. Doing great. Thank you. Almost done with the show. In 12 and 10 minutes, I'm going to be well, I will say metaphorically Miller time. In other words, it's quitting time, and so I can relax.
hopefully,
just metaphorically speaking. So you know. Yeah, okay. That's just the commercial. Yeah, so what's on your mind, Al?
Well, my question is concerning those with serious mental illnesses or brain defects. On one side, you could have someone with Down syndrome or those with, you know, without the mental capacity to really understand Christ's offer. Mm-hmm. And then on the other end, you can have someone who is, you know, a schizophrenic who, you know, on one day could actually be, you know, a Christian and another day could get into some gruesome, you know, sinful things.
Yeah.
So I'm curious to know where do you think those people stand in the eyes of the Lord, and how should we think about their capacity to be forgiven and saved?
Sure. You know, there are people with Tourette's syndrome. I mean, it's a crazy kind of thing. And I know somebody with Tourette's, actually. And actually, I know a couple of people, one very famous person, actually. And they're odd because they sometimes will say really weird things, and sometimes they're nasty what they say. But it's not something they control. It's because the Tourette's syndrome is messing with their minds, as it were, you know, and they're just or messing with their body, I guess, and they're saying these things. So I think if you are saying things like what they say, and they are just coming out, and you're not controlling it, then and you're not able to control it, then I don't think that's a sin. Your choices are not involved in that, so I don't think there's anything to be forgiven. Now, I probably in certain circumstances want to nuance this because there might be some exceptions to that, but broadly. In circumstances where people don't have the capacity to act appropriately, then the moral rules don't seem to apply to them. And the reason I say this is Scripture has a statement in Isaiah chapter 7. and it refers to a child who is going to be born, and then it says, before that child has the ability to discern the difference between right and wrong, some particular event was going to take place. So this child is born, and then within the next 3 or 4 or 5 years, something else is going to take place before the kid can figure out the difference between right and wrong. And we know that that is something that's developmental. It's based on the development of our brains that then allow our soulish capacities to express themselves through, in a certain sense, the machinery of the brain. So if a person, a child, a baby, does not have the capacity to know the difference between right and wrong, it just seems to me there's no way that they're going to be held responsible for that. And part of the reason I say that is in the Great White Throne Judgment at the end of the book, Revelation 20, people are judged by their deeds. They are judged by the wrong things that they did that they made a choice to do. Now, a six-month-old can't be making those choices because that child doesn't have the capacity to do so and therefore is not held responsible for it. Now, the reason I mention children is because I think there's a parallel with the kind of mental defects that you're describing, because in both cases, there is a mental inability. In the first case, with a six-year-old, it's not a defect because that's the way six-year-olds are. But if you have a 12, 15, 30, 60-year-old that is functioning morally on the level of a six-month-old, now that's a defect, because it's not supposed to be that way, but it still amounts to the same kind of thing. It amounts to a lack of capability to process the moral elements that are necessary to create moral culpability or responsibility or guilt. And I think so that would be my view of the way God sees those kinds of things, that it's tied up in or based on that capacity. And the soul certainly has its innate capacities to function morally, but the soul's capacities are limited when the soul is united with the body. It is limited by what the body can do. So this is why as we grow older, the capacities that are part of the makeup of our soul have the opportunity to express themselves, because now the machinery of the body, so to speak, can be the means by which the soul expresses its capacities or capabilities, and those include sure. moral ones as well. So I think that people with serious mental illnesses, I think that they, depending on the nature of the thing, they are not morally responsible. And incidentally, this is reflected in American jurisprudence. This is why we have guilty, not guilty on the basis of insanity, right? Some people are just, they just don't have it. They have whatever, mental illness, mental incapacity. And so consequently, they are not held responsible by the state for their behaviors.
And so you would even include the fully functional adult who, for whatever reason, somewhere along the line, the wires got crossed. And at times they do wicked things. I mean, we see it in the news all the time. You would still consider that, in the same light as someone who had Down syndrome or just never got to that age of reason.
Yeah. Well, what I'm saying is that you have to take these individual cases, basically. But I'm just saying in principle that there can be an adult person that has no more capacity in certain circumstances, or maybe through chronically, has no more capacity to make moral judgments than a six-month-old. And if that turns out to be the case, then I think there's that has an effect on the moral culpability or blameworthiness of that individual. Now, I will also add that I think this concept has been way overplayed in American jurisprudence. I think, you know, all this temporary insanity, or they didn't know what they were doing, or they ate too much candy, sure, and so they killed somebody. And this is kind of a, this is the candy defense, or the chocolate bar defense, or whatever they called that, you know. And one person who pressed this issue, and I don't know if he did so successfully, was the guy who in the monkey trial, what's his name, in the Scopes trial, Clarence Darrow. I mean, he's a famous attorney, and this is one of the things he did. I think he had two defendants that he was defending that were guilty of murder, and he tried to make the case that their circumstances and their mental framework, because of their circumstances and upbringing, whatever, rendered them incapable and they shouldn't be held guilty. I don't know if that particular ploy succeeded, and I think it succeeds more often probably than it should. Because I have a high view of individual responsibility, and our culture has a low view of individual responsibility. Like that lady who put the hot coffee between her legs and burned her legs,
right,
and sued McDonald's.
The McDonald's. Yeah.
What were you thinking? You know, it's like, huh? Why is McDonald's responsible for that? Anyway, so people are not held responsible, unfortunately, and so therefore they act more irresponsibly as a result, and that's not good for our communities. But in principle, I'm there. You know, I think that there are incapacities physically that also render one or become factors on assessing moral guilt of their behaviors. And any given situation, you got to look at it, you know, and just take it a case by case basis. But makes sense.
Just to kind of follow up, do you think that that line of thinking extends to someone under demonic influence?
Potentially. I'd have to think that through a little bit more, but you know, you had people that were doing pretty crazy things when they were demon possessed. And in the case of demon possession, right, even in the New Testament, it's the demon that's doing it. The person is the victim. And that's the way Jesus treated, yeah, you know, the Gadarene demoniacs there in Mark 5 and some other passages. Anyway, I think my music's coming up here, ought to be, and I can't hear it because I'm out of touch with my team. But I got to say goodbye to you. Thanks so much, Alan Dallas. I appreciate the call, and it's been great being part of your day, whatever time of day that is that you're listening. Greg Kokel here for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven. Bye-bye now.